Welcome to Dublin City University Conflict Institute Podcasts, bringing you in-depth analysis of some of the key contemporary issues in international affairs, with a focus on analysing conflict resolution, peace building, and security issues.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Conflict Institute podcast. My name is Hari. I'm a researcher at the Institute. And today we'll be talking about Sudan's revolution with Sarah Kreta, who is an award-winning journalist and a documentary filmmaker with extensive experience investigating human rights abuses. Recently, she was in Sudan to cover the uprising as a journalist. And she's also a Marie Curie early stage researcher at the Institute for Foreign Media and Journalism at Dublin City University. Welcome, Sarah, and thank you for talking to us. Could you sort of begin by giving us a context of what is happening in Sudan? What changed in 2019, and what's the nature of the transitional government that is in power at the moment?
So what happened in Sudan, especially what we experienced in the Sudan Popular Uprising that began in December 2018, marks an important development in the contemporary history of social protest, especially in Global South. For the first time, after Sudan gained independence in 1956, a social movement in the country peacefully organized, toppled a military dictatorship. I want to mention this because, again, when we talk about social movement and when we talk about this massive demonstration, we tend to forget the historical elements of how these movements are created and shaped in countries like Sudan, especially when we look at the role of the Sudanese Professional Association, that is this umbrella of professionals that were behind this massive demonstration in Khartoum in 2018, we see that this movement are capable of embracing a diverse and common human aspiration to freedom, social, radical, and acting justice. So they are not just movements that have the capacity and the imagination to lead what happened in as a revolution, right? To fight for citizen structural change and using peaceful means. But this is also part of the Sudanese history of protest and failed achieve, right? So the Sudanese Professional Association is a kind of past in the present. It represents this long history of Sudanese professionals that are our persistent attempt to form independent trade union in the country and independent bodies to defend the right of the worker and to improve working condition. In the past, there were several attempts to build such bodies, notably in 2012 and in 2014. Both attempts failed to achieve their goal because of the regime, because of the pressure and the arrest or the persecution. Many of the people that were part of this movement were forced into exile, and they were continuing this from abroad. So what I think is interesting here in this movement of civil disobedience is that that lately create rallies, march, and so on, is how they have taken the call to protest beyond the limit of Khartoum. And this is something interesting, especially when you look at the history of Sudan and the dynamic in Sudan, right? With the center, Khartoum, and the elite, and the peripheries. So those groups, those population, those citizens that were always left aside, right? In rural area or in areas that were marked by conflict or violence. So this work created by the Sudanese Professional Association that again continue this movement of aspiration that was repressed in the past, it's a mix of these teacher committees, Sudanese doctors, lawyers, journalists, but also engineers, health officer professionals that are together. So what I said, this follow a history of Sudan that is marked by the creation of Revolutionary Committee in the past, in October 1964, but also in 1985, you know, when other movements in Sudan were marked by the same spirit. So again, you see that the history is repeating itself. You have this protest, you have a military coup, then you have again a kind of transition period, and then again, you know, because we see that this movement led by the Sudanese Professional Association then created these opposition forces. They create a declaration for freedom and change. That's again a group of opposition groups, people with very different ideas and also political idea. You know, you have from the communists sitting together with the less radical political groups, right? So you see how the forces of freedom and change compromised after 8 months of protests, in which more than 200 people were killed by security forces, the demand of the country, right? A country where conflict pursued by Omar al-Bashir for 30 years. There is a cratering economy with more than 9 million people in need of aid, and with millions of people that were forced from their home. They kind of like these forces of freedom and change gambled the ultimate goal of a democratic change and an economic reform into this new technocrat-led government that's a mix of military powers and civilian. What I like to use here is a word in Arabic that is tajli. That's a kind of word to say that how they play in a kind of delaying. They want to avoid confrontation with the generals, and they want to, you know, gamble this ultimate goal for democratic change. Some activists, some people that were in the street in Sudan in early December 2018, but also later, or people that have been protesting from abroad yet have not go back. And for me, this is a very interesting sign because when people were shouting in the square in Khartoum in 2018 and 19, they were shouting Tasgubbas, that means just fold, right? They wanted the fall of the regime. And for them, the regime didn't fall yet. So for them, this kind of technocrat-led government it's just a continuation of the same powers that they were there in the past. And then we can, you know, analyze the role of the different powers, especially the role of the rapid support forces, that is a militia that's part of the security environment, and the security reform at Sudan are at stage, at least in the current period. We see that a lot of elements are still in need to be addressed.
For somebody who looks from the outside, it looks like one of the greatest contradictions that exists at the moment is the fact that what we have in transition government is a military-civil society coalition of some sort, right? Do you think that is what the weakness of the outcome of the revolution has been?
So rapid support forces are one of the most powerful paramilitary forces in Sudan. The head of the rapid support forces is the vice chair of the Sovereignty Council, Mohamed Hemeti Hamda Daglo, right? We first see that MET rose in the history of Sudan in 2003. And for those who know Sudan, those years are marked with the conflict in Darfur and with the violence in Darfur. Definitely for a majority of the Sudanese, Mohamed MET represents those moments of human rights violation and abuses that happen in Darfur, and especially his forces, the Janjaweed, are integrated in the rapid support forces, represent some of the Sudan security architecture that raise a lot of question on the prospect of democratic transition. However, I think we should note that also in other conflict and in other situation, the existence of these security forces bring, you know, some counter evidences. For example, if you read this book of Axel Deval and his book on real politics of the Horn of Africa, Money, War and Business, he used this term that is peacekeeping great tourism, yeah, to describe how Uganda and Burundi contribute to peacekeeping troops in Somalia for financial gains. Why I bring this concept here, and you know, the role of like paramilitary forces in conflicts in the region, right? Because the same thing happened with the rapid support forces. The rapid support forces were used in Yemen, in the war in Yemen, led by the Arab coalition there, funded by the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, right? So we see that the RSF went to Yemen to fight a war there, and then they were rewarded generously for their involvement and for their engagement. And then, you know, we see again rapid support forces used to control movement from Sudan to Libya, and European country with their aim to stem migration to Europe, supporting the rapid support forces and training the rapid support forces, and, you know, at the same time using the rapid support forces and the fact that they control the territory for their aim, right, to stem migration to Europe. I mean, we see that this group are domestically very rewarded, and they also control resources. Like the rapid support forces have a huge hand on the gold rich Jamal Marra region. And then, you know, we see that in this like post revolutionary government, their role is still present, right? No matter what, they have a history of human rights atrocity or, you know, past counter insurgency. I think what is interesting here is how to engage with these forces. And this, I think, should be the central question. Because first, the purpose of these forces, like they are no matter what, especially with the conflict in Sudan and in the region of Darfur, they represent counter-insurgency movement and violence that happened there. So this should be addressed. Secondly, the RSF is legitimately formed through a statute that was ratified by the parliament. But this should be noted that has no legal order whatsoever, you know? So basically the parliament that instituted these forces is not representative of the whole Sudanese. So this is also explain how, you know, these forces were legitimate in the name of counterinsurgency to control a rebel movement, right, in the region of Darfur and so on. So if the RSF wished to exist as an independent, you know, kind of force, or then its statutory law should be subject to public scrutiny and approval. And then finally, I think if we try to look at the rebellion in Darfur or elsewhere, right, and the crimes that were committed against specific community, then we should, you know, also ask, does Sudan require a force with such a mandate today? I think this should be a question that the citizen of Sudan should answer, you know, in parliament, and it shouldn't be the RSF to decide their status, right? So in a way, I think that the place of the RSF and the role as such, you know, if we see especially what happened in the past, should be ranked peacefully in a transition that include them more broadly. So the question here is about the integration. It's not matter of, okay, let's negotiate. How are we going to deal with the RSF? But how are we reforming the RSF? And how are we, you know, charting this into a way to democratic transition? Because again, if Sudan is to bid farewell to the dictatorship and the dictatorial and a like colossal atrocity that happened in the past, then this should be, you know, carried out by a process of justice seeking and, you know, those that are behind the manipulation of violence and behind the violence that happened in the past should, you know, should face justice or should face a process of transition, transitional justice in a way that the monopoly of violence shouldn't be in the hand of the state. But should be under the control of a civilian rule.
Right. Yes. And I think that sort of puts it well into the next question that I wanted to have, which is, so what you're saying now is that even the post coup government, the transitional government that's in power, continues to use paramilitary force. It continues to violently crush protests that's happening. And you also mentioned the role that the paramilitary forces were having on continued violence on the people, right? And I remember you'd written that violence against women has continued even in the post-coup, sort of post-revolution government that's in power. But I was reading recently that last year there were some changes that were made in the constitution that that made it possible for women, for example, to wear the attire that they wanted in public, because that was a law. There was a law that restricted all of that. So there seem to be some changes constitutionally happening. Is that a sign that there is some change happening, or do you think that these are just sort of facades and that violence against women specifically sort of continues to exist?
Yeah, I think the fact that women on Sudan, I mean, ruling and kind of conquest, you know, their space and their ability from the protests to put, you know, to pushing for lasting change. I mean, definitely women were visible, were on the front line, were on the protests, were in the square through music, poetry, whatsoever, politics, and you know, and even women are part of the transition, and the definitely, I mean, we see that the transition constitution also guarantees 40% representation to women. So I mean, this is, I think, our great step, especially when we see the history of Sudan and how the role of women was politicized by the previous regime, and you know the historical context, right? But again, let's not just talk about this without including the historical context, because again, the Sudanese Women Union was formed in 1952, and this is for me is a strong example of how women have been fighting for political change, and the way that dictators later, right, curb the movement, for example, limiting and co-opting women representation through political quotas or outlawing women non-government organization, jailing the opposition. These are just tactics, right, that were used. But if you look at the history of Sudan, Fatima Ahmed Ibrahim was the first woman voting into parliament in Sudan in 1960s, right? So what has changed, right? Yeah, I mean, we see that following several months of protests, then, you know, the Sudanese protesters achieve, you know, one of their biggest goals, the creation of a transitional civilian government, right? But again, I think what is interesting here is that the change that happened in the legislation that affect definitely the life of women across Sudan, for example, I just want to mention the repressive public order law that, you know, were polishing how women act in public space, what women wear in public space, and so on. you know, the female genital mutilation that has been outlawed, and, you know, execution of children that have been banned. I mean, definitely light. Now women no longer need their consent of their husband or male guardian to travel. I think this is these are very good progress. But still, I think there are a lot of challenging, especially an economic situation that has been already struggling under former Omar al-Bashir, former President Omar al-Bashir. They have not recovered under the new administration, new restriction also, and the COVID pandemic. So if we see that protesters have returned to the street to voice, you know, their displeasure over the current measure and condition, especially on the economic reform, I think also for women, the march for equal representation continues. I mean, they now have the possibility to fill 120 seats in the parliament, in the transitional council, you know, to prepare for the election. And then also the UN funded a mapping exercise to promote political participation of women, especially women that could represent their communities, you know, despite barriers that still exist, you know, like patriarchal system, lack of training, travel expenses to travel, and so on. So what I want to say here is that, of course, right, this progresses and, you know, challenge that women have faced in the past have been addressed. And there is a will, right, to include, you know, a better participation of women into the political sphere. But again, this doesn't come from nowhere. Like, there's an history there of women that were already trying, you know, to be part, but they were silenced by the dictatorship and by this, dictator rules.
Hmm. That sort of also brings me to another question, which I had on media restrictions and censorship. Right now, I know you've mentioned to me earlier before we started the conversation that censorship is an issue that Sudan has been dealing with for a really long time, even during the dictatorial government before. The new government, transitional government, has already made substantial commitments to the media freedom using the UNESCO's media development indicators. Yet, you seem to suggest that censorship continues to remain an issue. Can you tell us a little bit more about media freedoms, both journalistic and also social media freedoms in Sudan, please?
Yeah, so again, let's put a bit of context here, especially how the role of media in these 30 years of military dictatorship and how, you know, critical voices were silenced or forced into exile. And how also the government, the previous government, have used internet to spread disinformation or manipulate social media through what they call the cyber jihadist unit. That was a unit that was operating under the former NIS, that is this basically national security service that was under the control of the political elite during the dictatorship. There are studies that suggest that this unit has received training in Malaysia and in India, and they were basically used to attack activists or to surveil political commentators or political leaders. And so, I mean, definitely, if we see that social media platform played a role in Sudan youth-led revolution, there is also the other side of how social media were used to control and to try to silence activists. In particular, we see how the social media have been used to mobilize and to document protests, because definitely, I mean, the dictatorship that, yeah, was recently replaced with the Transitional Military Council was a country, like Sudan was a country where there was no pluralism in media, where, you know, media were controlled and were shaped by the government. So with this new, let's say, roadmap that the government endorsed and, you know, the priority that they have in mind for the transition also of the media and how media can, you know, become and bring change into the future of Sudan, there are a step of reform from legal to regulatory reform to, you know, especially to ensure editorial independence and free expression, but also to increase pluralism, media ownership, and, you know, like advance education on media skills and training. But definitely, I think there is a huge need, for example, to modernize media infrastructure. And media, I mean, are devastated by three decades of censorship and harassment, right? So this reform are promises, but yeah, have yet to materialize. Consider that all the trade union in the country have been dissolved, include the Union of Sudanese Journalists. And this, you know, I mean, this decision to dissolve trade union, it's also kind of internationally awful and unconstitutionally and nationally, right? If you look at how journalists were organizing for change in the past and how they were, you know, using this union also to, you know, bring a new wave of political involvement and et cetera. So what I want to say here is that journalists still face intimidation, harassment, and restriction. This measure have been intensified during the COVID. For example, in May 2020, local authorities have arrested two women journalists that were reporting on COVID pandemic in Darfur. So this, for example, show how, you know, if we want to understand how different stakeholders, policymakers, journalists, media development practitioners, and everyone involved, you know, into this conceptual idea of media freedom and what action are necessary, you know, to enhance and safeguard the principle and practice of media freedom, then, you know, we still need to understand how this is perceived, you know, by, yeah, promises. And definitely, I mean, even the interim constitution is enriched by the terms of freedom of expression, right to access the internet, and, you know, like they definitely mention all the international agreements ratified by Sudan. But as such, then, you know, I think there is a need for repressive law to be in practice, right? Readapt and reshape, and the role of journalist union, right, should be integrated in this process. So for example, the 2009 law that, you know, was a law that enabled strict state control over the press and journalism, that was a law that was used to license and approve, you know, certain type of newspaper, or, you know, provide criminal sanction for media outlets and journalists. This law needs still to be discussed, and you know, what's going to happen, right? Because if there are amendments that are signed, for example, recently the cyber law was amended. But again, I see as certain element have been used to avoid criticism for the current transitional government, right? So how this broad broad measures that were created by the former regime, as we said, to target online criticism or, you know, to control dissent. Now, to avoid this to repeat, we need to ensure that Sudan and the new powers that are there are not just suppressed, and they are integrated in this transitional government. And definitely, I think it's not just about, you know, putting there some amendment or new law to, you know, avoid criticism for the transitional government, but then we should ask what is the common denominator in journalistic and public attitude toward media freedom, you know? And here I think it's interesting to look, for example, at the way of Sudanese TV and the role of, you know, like public broadcasting media and how this has also been shaped, right? Through the fact that right now media are able to criticize the transitional government, or media are able to, you know, challenge. But again, what is important is to consider what are the conditions that are able to articulate media freedom. And for me, there should be access to sources, commitment to professionalism by media institution, but also legal and governmental structure, right? To define the profession of journalists and to protect journalists, and law, right, to ensure the right to obtain information and protect sources. So, yeah, I think the perspective of journalists should be taken into consideration, especially those journalists that have been fighting, you know, to report for all this year, and those journalists that have been facing limitation related to publishing or other form of censorship, that definitely is coupled with political pressure, right? And this is also make media freedom difficult in practicing media freedom.
Interesting. As we sort of begin to wind down, I want to spend the next few minutes that we have left to talk about the response to what has been happening in Sudan from the West, right? How has the relationship of the new transitional government changed with the rest of the world? Countries like the US, the European Union, have they shown any interest in what's happening? Have they intervened in some sense to make things better?
Yeah, so maybe we could talk about the International Monetary Fund. And also how the International Monetary Fund have been adopting a program for Sudan last year that demanded the Sudanese government to implement several austerity measures. One of these is the removal of state subsidies. And this, if we look at how the economic reform are accompanied by policies that are aimed at alleviating the burden on the public of implementing this reform, including the direct support to families or other programs that were supported by the International Monetary Fund to encourage family to basically seek support by the transitional government, we see that there is a huge economic fragility and a near bankrupt government. I mean, for me, this is a critical issue if we look at the ability for the government to provide any kind of services to a citizen. And there has been some sponsor by the United Nations, European Union, German government, you know, Partnership Forum for Sudan. Recently in Paris, there was another event for, again, you know, Paris conference, which was organized to support democratic transition in Sudan and encourage international investment and partnership. But yet we see that the government started to liberalizing fuel and battle the cartels run economic and older regime that were benefiting, right, from these subsidies. And all this shadow economy, right, that was controlled by the military and the former regime, we see the impact, right? I mean, the challenge are huge, especially if we see that, like with the subsidies, for example, right? They wanted to liberalize the Sudanese pound, and they want to introduce these new economic measures. We see that more than 2 million mines are controlled, and the gold production is controlled. So basically we see, like, for people that have no maybe idea, let's start like this. The role of the World Bank and the grant that are, you know, a valuable demonstration of the political support that Sudan is pledging internationally, we see that in terms of real dollar and question of how much this commitment will actually be new money or will actually be, another aid that will be given to Sudan in support of some kind of, you know, measures that we are asking to Sudan to implement, right? So we see that there is a kind of winning door, backing Entele, putting in place like painful economic reform, including removing fuel and subsidies, right? State subsidies. But then, you know, there is an issue with the climate change, or, you know, like the 60% of the Sudanese population that lives in poverty. Okay, the government has made a start on liberalizing fuel and, you know, battling cartels run by the former military and the old regime who are benefiting from these subsidies and this shadow economy, you know, where the government has very little control. But then how the impact of this reform that the government launched, you know, under this flagship safety net scheme that was sponsored by the Monetary Fund. For example, the program was to assist families that are 80% of the Sudanese population basically are in need. And then they proposed this scheme that was giving $5 a month for a family, right? So when you speak with family in Sudan, or when you speak with area like Sudanese poorest region, you know, like how these programs are going to really happen those people. So I'm really afraid that if military-run companies still dominate the economy and no one can profit from this, I think recently there was an estimate of $2 billion annually. It's very difficult to reach the state treasury. And then how the government, including those security forces that we see were part of this violent repression in the past, controlling, you know, the resources of Sudan. In International Monetary Fund monitoring program, then we see that there is a huge influence on the shadow state, right? That is still there. So I think, I think that the first step that was to remove Sudan from the list of state sponsor of terrorism is a huge, step. You know, like for example, activists in Sudan, they were not able to subscribe to Twitter because of that. Or they were not able to use Gmail because of that, right? Like thinking like from the basic kind of impact that this measure can have, right? But then I think the key question here is the question of justice and how the question of justice would be tackled. We see that Hemeti influence is growing. We see that the RSF involvement in war in Yemen, Libya, you know, has cemented support for Hemeti, especially amongst the Gulf state. And these states are influencing the transition. So what is going, because Sudan, it's a country that has a very interesting position, you know, in and these former warlords that are retain a major stake in poorly regulated gold business are definitely, you know, interested in selling this gold to gold states, for example, or to China, right? So that's how I think the West is balancing his power, right? And how the West can, you know, propose interesting measure. How can the West propose interesting measure when the majority of the money coming to Sudan are coming from the gold mining that is sold to Gulf countries? And this money are in the hand of a warlord that controls the economy. And recently, you know, he is trying to, you know, boast his image using Canada-based lobbying firms and, you know, launching a social media campaign to, you know, to show how he is able to respond to crises like COVID crisis, vaccination campaign, disinfecting the street, you know, providing free medical care. And this also this complicates the work of human rights lawyers, you know, that are leading government investigation, for example, in the massacre of last June, the 3 June 2019, right? When the MIT forces were accused of shooting on protesters. So yeah, that's why I think if Sudan has not had an independent, impartial, and transparent judiciary system for the past 30 years, will be very difficult to tackle this issue, right, for the future, and especially to reach peace, that is a key goal of the transitional government, you know, to end historical conflict that have waged in Darfur, Blue Nile, or Kordofan.
Right. Yes, and I think that sort of nicely puts down the discussion that we've been having so far. And my sense, what you're telling me is that there is a transitional government in power, but there are clearly a lot of issues that obviously need to be addressed for that transition to be peaceful, for there to be transitional justice. Thank you, Sarah, for talking to us. I think that was very insightful for anyone who's listening and does not have a very detailed background of what's happening in Sudan. Thank you for listening to us, and we will get back to you with another podcast, another guest, talking about another political issue in the next episode. Thank you very much.